Finally, I want to thank Joe Ritchie. I'm not sure he's in the audience, but Joe Ritchie really is the grandfather of AGMIP at ASA and was from the beginning just absolutely terrific about, I think, setting us on a good path, a great path for both for the use of data in models, which is really the challenge of AGMIP and what I'm going to be talking about this morning, and the use case of using data for agricultural models. Just, I'm going to tell you what AGMIP stands for. AGMIP stands for, and then we're going to call it AGMIP for the rest of the time. But AGMIP stands for the Agricultural Model Intercomparison and Improvement Project. So I'm going to cover four topics. I'm going to give a brief introduction to AGMIP, then looking at our own challenges of bridging the data user gap. Then I'm going to talk about an exciting new effort that many partners are coming together to create a national agricultural research data network for harmonized data. And then here comes the use case, enabling these data to be used in coordinated global and regional assessments of climate variability and change. First, the AGMIP mission is to provide effective, science-based agricultural decision-making models and assessments, not just the models themselves, but using them in assessments of climate variability and change and sustainable farming systems to achieve local to global food security. AGMIP is a worldwide science community. It has about 800 members, and it's growing every day. So for those of you who are both data providers for models and modelers, please go to the website, www.agmip.org, and become a member of AGMIP. It's a true worldwide science community. It's not only the individual scientists who are part of AGMIP, but it's their institutions. So this slide is showing some of the many partners and donor institutions who are involved in AGMIP. But let's now turn to the challenges that we've been talking about this morning. This is another formulation of the data to knowledge, and perhaps even beyond knowledge to wisdom. But I want to call your attention to the top first, those four circles on the top, which are the users: research, government, business, NGO foundations, extension agents, many, many, many users of agricultural data and models. So how do we then, from the base of the pyramid with data, work our way up to the top of that pyramid through information, through knowledge, to create knowledge, and we certainly hope wisdom at the end? And on the sides of the triangle are some of the kinds of tools that we've been discussing and hearing from the other speakers this morning. So I want to first focus on the users and the use cases, because the way that we work in AGMIP is we start with who are the users, which group of users, are they extension agents, are they working on evaluating technologies? Is it a group of decision makers who are evaluating technologies for sustainable agriculture? Are they donors who are investing in agricultural projects? Are they farm advisors, commercial agronomists who are providing management support for precision agriculture? Are they corporate sustainability officers who need to know what is actually going into the food system that is part of their corporate activity? That helps us shape the questions and then form the impetus for the creation of the knowledge chain that we were then looking at and in the previous pyramid. But what we find when we work with the users is that there is a tremendous gap between the users and the data. I think we all realize this, that there is a gap a huge gap between the potential value of data collected. And here we're going to be focusing primarily on data that is collected in agricultural experiments and the value currently obtained through the use of those data. So typically, still, the data collected in experiments are used for the original research purpose only. It's like a one-off, all that experiment, all that great work. And then those results were perhaps published, but they were used only for that purpose. So the challenge, as we've been hearing about, is to really tap and create a vastly greater value that can be obtained if the data were combined across locations, time, and management conditions. So how do we actually do that? And one way that we do that in terms of thinking all the way through to the user is the use of models. So this is an arrow or bridge to show how the data can be manipulated, developed, so they can actually be usable. So we've heard some about the locatable part and cataloging, that data needs to be accessible and machine readable. That's really the easy part. The hard part, and where we really are and what we're working on in AgMIMP, is the usable, reusable part with developing four experiment station data, ontologies, discovery tools, computation and analytic tools, models, articles and data linkages, curation, and interoperability. Of course, the reproducible part is very important, and we heard about some of that from Bill, and the keeping great notes on the virtual notebooks and publishing those as well. But we're really focusing here and in our efforts in AgMIMP on the usability and reusability into models. So what Jim and others, some on the panel and some who in the society have been working on and with other partners, is to create a National Agricultural Research Data Network. I'm going to call it NARDIN. You can kind of think about it like a garden for agricultural data, but focusing on the harmonization of the data. So what does harmonized data mean? So it means that the data are translated into a common set of variable names, units, and formats so that they can be used. And models is one of those main use cases. We're doing this effort with many partners, and also we're very open to all partners who are interested. National Agricultural Library, experiment stations, the USDA ARS, NIFA. And we're working at first in 13 states. We're putting together a coalition of 13 states, but we very much want to build it out nationally and internationally as well. We're in touch with the CGIAR system and other international efforts so that eventually all these data and harmonized data networks can be linked up and talk to each other. So in the schematic, you see that there's the Ag Data Commons, which is being developed by USDA ARS with the data and the metadata. But then there's this other part that we have the dashed lines around, which are the part that actually what's needed to make those datable, usable, and reusable in models and other applications. So what are the components of the NARDIN HD? So they are things like the metadata, we heard about that from Bill, the description of the data sets available in the harmonized format anywhere in the network. And oh, by the way, I just wanted to go back here and say, so there's a master node for the NARDIN, but it doesn't all have to be centralized, doesn't have to all be in one place. And we've already are working with nodes. There are already nodes that are already started. For example, in Purdue and Idaho and Michigan State. So it's not to bring everything into one giant central place, but it's really to link up the great work and networking that's already started to create a network of networks. Well, let's go back to the components. So we have our metadata. So anywhere in the network across the central part and the nodes, we know what's there. We have that the data also have a common format. And I'm going to tell a little bit more about the ICASA common data format, because this is a format that crop modelers have been using for, I don't know, two decades or so. I'm looking at Jim. He'll be able to say exactly. But this common data format has been under development for a long time. Many workshops coming together from U.S. crop modelers and crop modelers around the world to create this. Of course, there needs to be data dictionaries, which are basically, well, which variables and units are we considering for this usability and reusability? So it's not so much every single thing. There's also some kind of reality check of, well, these are the real useful things that we need, primarily, and we can all agree on going forward. And then, of course, we need data translators. These are the actual software tools that can translate a data that's in data that's in one format into the ICASA common data format, for example. So what does this NARDIN HD really offer in terms of opportunities? This is, what can we do with these data that are now curated? We could also use that common word. They can be used to identify, access, and use quantitative data to develop and evaluate agricultural systems models, whether they are statistical. We've been hearing a lot about statistical models, but a lot of the models that are utilized in the biophysical world are dynamic models, and then also the meta-analyses that we also have heard about, those performing the meta-analyses across space and time. They can also be used to understand, to improve understanding the genotype, environment, and management interactions that are so much a heart of what the Agronomy Society and the scientists and researchers here are all about. So in phase one of NARDIN, we're focusing on field experiments and variety trials. That's the first major data type that we are practicing, that we're developing these tools for, the NARDIN HD4. But we do soon want to, we want to do a lot of learning on this part, because we want to then go on, for example, and add socioeconomic data that are used in models. And our another AGMET PI is here, John Antle, who is an economic modeler. And so we don't, in order to really solve many of the users' questions, we need to do modeling both on the biophysical side and the socioeconomic side. So we're already in discussion with John and his colleagues about how we can bring socioeconomic data into the NARDIN as well. But let's focus first now on the field data for crop models. Experiments routinely collect common variables, including, we all know these, final grain yield and biomass, first flowering and maturity dates for the phenology, plant and grain biomass, leaf area, nutrient competition. So that's on the plant side. We need some other data, though, to really make these work in the dynamic models, crop models. We have to have weather data. We need soil data and management details. What was the planting date? What was the fertilizer regime? What was the irrigation regime, for example? So that these data sets can be used to evaluate and improve crop models, which are increasingly used for research and decision support. And there's a schematic of the dynamic crop model at the bottom. So I mentioned the ICASA standards. So NARDIN HD is using these standards. There's 30 years, I have it on another slide, it's more than 20, 30 years of experience. Balance is necessary, detail versus approximations. Completeness in specifying the environment, initial soil conditions, daily weather. These are the kinds of things that we need to have a functioning crop model. Completeness in specifying management. We already have data for many annual crops. There are standards for rotations and intercropping. And while I said we have to limit the variables, but there's still an awful lot, so there are about 600 or more for the metadata and management. These standards are strong, in particular, to not only understand the crop growth, but what's going on with the environment and the management. That, remember our use case of our extension agents, for example. And also the phenotypes for crop physiology and agronomy of major annual crops. And I want to acknowledge the great work of Jeff White, who has been really bringing these standards up and bringing them up to their usefulness, that the state of usefulness that they really are. Just wanted to also say that there another area that just as we want to include socioeconomic data, we also want to include genomic data as well as another extension area of the NARDA. So how does this really, how do we draw these strong relevance, the strong links to extension? We have our farmers or our farm professionals with a question. And here we have many, many, many USDA-funded experiments that are producing the data. Then we have that, so that accessibility is very important. Then we have this role of the calibration and the harmonization of the data through the modeling that I was just describing, so that there can be results of management practices and recommendations that farmers can trust. So, we've been primarily talking about the United States, and NARDIN is beginning in the United States, but AgMIP works all over the world. So everything that we're talking about now of it getting our act together on the U.S. national side, we also need to do internationally. So one of the things that AgMIP does is it does for not only the major crops that are shown here, but also many of the minor crops as well, and other important crops in other regions, to do crop model intercomparison and improvement studies. Right now, primarily those teams are using only 4 sites per crop. The initial studies, they're now creeping up. I think wheat is now doing 30, and I think the rice is up to about 300. But what we really need is to go from 4 sites per crop with these excellent experimental data, field trial data that can train the models in across all these different environments, to what if we had 4,000 instead of just the 4 that have been used in the initial studies? That will really help us to improve the models and, very importantly, increase the credibility of the results. So just to share some of the results from the wheat pilot study, which was done in the Netherlands, Argentina, India, and Australia, you see grain yield. The X's are the observed data from the field sites. We call them our sentinel sites. And the 2 bars are we give the modelers, the wheat modelers around the world, and these were 27 wheat models. We give them just limited amount of data. And you can see when you have limited data, you have much uncertainty in the model results. Then we give them the full set of data. Then Sentel and Frank Ebert, the leaders of the wheat team, provided all the modelers with the full set of data. And you see that the uncertainty of the model ensemble results are much lower in well-calibrated simulations. So this is only the 4 sites. Think about having, as I said, 4,000. I mean, I just took the number because it's orders of magnitude. But think about having this strength and rigor of our data that we can really do tremendous significant improvement in our models, our modeling around the world. Now that, the reason why we want to do this is, so here were the 4 sites, but AgMIP works on crops globally, as I said, and we utilize the models that are used at sites, but we also use them on grids all across the world. So this is projections of climate change effects on global crops for the 2080s. And this is with 7 global gridded crop models with 5 different representations of the future climate. And the reason why it's so important that we get the up to the 4,000 is because we're not only working with, for example, the extension agents in the regions of the world, we are also working globally to understand how a changing climate will affect world food supply everywhere. I'm going to take it now one more step forward, which is that this is on the biophysical side. We have to get that absolutely right from the agronomy side, because then we are now embarking in AgMIP on coordinated global and regional assessments of agriculture and food security. But that includes not just the biophysical side, but the economic side as well. So we have teams of AgMIP working on farming systems, regional. You see in the upper left hand, that's the farming systems in regions all around the world, including US and North America. We use the global gridded models to fill in, but that's why we have to have it's still based on the sites. We work with a global economics team who are finding out from these biophysical changes, from these crop yield changes, what are the implications for food prices around the world, and then it cycles back to what on the regional modeling that we do on economics, we can find out what the prices are, but not only prices, but also what the outcomes are in terms of livelihoods for farmers, not just in the United States, but around the world. So let's come back to our knowledge chain. What we see very much from the pyramid is that data is the foundation of the knowledge chain, all the way up to, we hope, our wisdom and our users. But it must be usable. So final thoughts are that the NARD and HD needs to be extended nationally. We're just now planning the pilot, as I said, in 13 states with wonderful partners at land-grant universities, USDA, ARS, sites and others. But we're already connecting with the international networks, but we have a big challenge. We have to do it here, as in the US, as well as internationally. And the reason why, in this case, the use case coming from AgMIP, is that that these usable data are required for coordinated national, regional, and global food security assessments, such as for the U.S. National Assessment and for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, AR6. But in order for us to answer the questions that are being posed to us, the data harmonization is essential. Thank you very much. For protocols and the up-to-date events and news, and to join, please see the website. Thank you very much.
Kay and Bill, would you join us back on the dais? And now, please stay. I realize there's lots of interesting things going on. We would very much like to have an open forum. Hear your questions. A lot was presented, a lot of really interesting tidbits, and this is an opportunity to ask bluntly, what is in it for you? You as a scientist, you as a member of a professional society, you as a professional agronomist, the why should we? Because we are not necessarily doing this very well in agriculture. We clearly have some tools out there that we could adopt, and adapt, but I think there are some significant barriers that need to be overcome, and we want to hear your thoughts, your ideas, as well as your questions.
Good morning. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Jeff Falenik, and I was asked by Paul Fixon to moderate the question and answer session. And so what I would do is encourage people to come to the microphones, please, on either end. Please do so at your earliest convenience. And Jeff White jumps right up. And please identify yourself and your affiliation to give our panel a perspective, a little context from which to understand your question. So please, Jeff.
Should I start over, or was I yelling loud enough?
Just restate it, Jeff, I think.
Okay. So my question is how to avoid a Tower of Babel problem where we end up with 60 different data portals, each one soaking up data in different formats or whatever format the researcher feels best suits their need, or as one of the slides shows. My standard is the correct standard.
So who wants to field?
Go ahead.
Then
anytime we have data
one. Okay. Well, one approach is this. For the audience here, there are probably X number, maybe a dozen or more different repositories that might be most appropriate for whatever type of data you're particularly working on in your laboratory. So the best thing is to work with those established repositories that you may already have a relationship with. And then in the future, more and more individual repositories are going to be joining federations like Data One that make it easy to discover the data that are affiliated with those different repositories. So we're going to see more of that down the road as it becomes increasingly important to be able to find and access those data wherever they may be. The important thing, I think, is to use a well-established, solid repository and ideally community standards for metadata as well as data formats.
I agree. We have that problem just looking at registries and trials. There is a portal through WHO, but it's currently underfunded. And so it's the portal to all the different registries is not very good. And so everything's at risk since the portal is good. Another example would be the tobacco repository. There are, I think, three repositories worldwide where the tobacco papers have gone. And also GenBank. Genetic database. So where you can get international cooperation, that's ideal. But the amount of money put into it can be a problem, as we've seen with the WHO portal for the trials registry.
I guess, Jeff, my thinking too is that I think most of us would envision something like Google. Like Google Scholar, you really don't care where the article resides or where the data resides in this case. You just type it into some search engine and it comes up, the data that you're looking for. That's a big picture vision. You know, that's a nice place to be, but we're not there. We have a long ways to go.
I think that Jeff's comment actually speaks to a key element of where whatever portal you go through, what you send through that portal must be
tagged, described with terms that one would logically use to discover it. And I think that's as big a problem as anything. You can do all the other elements, but if you do not do certain things to make your data discoverable, then you've got a problem.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Over here.
Yeah, thanks very much. Jeff Harris, Field Scientist at ARS and leading the Land Retention Knowledge Systems Project. First, thanks to all the speakers. This is really good and it's really exciting to see the progress that's been made. My question is, this session is really focused primarily on research-grade data, and I'm wondering about the extent to which local farmer data, in particular smaller farmers who may not have the sensors on their John Deere tractors, that's automatically sending yield data up into the cloud. To what extent this group is considered, in particular, something I think of the Agnet, but also Bill mentioned some opportunities with the IR group. Your thoughts on data quality issues and all the challenges associated with that. Thanks.
So, what's the first effort that we have to started 5 years ago? I'm not sure Ken Duty is here, but we started something called the Agnet Sentinel Site approach. And it actually is a kind of like a good housekeeping seal of approval for experiment data. And we have different, it's also a triangle, and it has, I don't know what the bottom layer is called, whether I think it was bronze, silver, gold, platinum. And so what we try to do, and we have, I believe, a couple of papers that have been published on this from Agnet. And we have, it's with a particular objective in mind, which is the use of those data for a crop modeling. And that's why we have to have, for example, the phenology dates when the crop goes from one growth stage to another, because we can't calibrate the models very well if we don't have that. By the way, that's what was really shown on those model results collections. So, but that date of that bottom is a bronze. Some of the farmer data there, I think, could be very exciting, and we've also heard from some programs, for example, in Bobbing and some of the Dutch are doing, they're really now doing farmer data collection with the scientists so that it can be more useful. So I think that, I would say that that's what we'd be very happy to participate in such a program. But we do need them to be useful for the model.
There are two tools or approaches that I would recommend. One, the example I've shown of Dash, is a great tool for taking in tabular data, variable quality, and loving the data producer or the farmer or whoever created it. Better stewards, so there's guidelines in there and helpful hints about how to clean up the spreadsheets, and there's preservation ready. You can add quote documentation to it, and it's simply described, so it's not some complex metadata standard. It's pretty easy to, for someone of the general public to go and use that tool very effectively. Secondly, there's a huge emphasis the last 2 years, in fact, out of the White House, I think last month, there was a major announcement about support for citizen science within all the federal agencies. And this creates a lot of opportunities and a lot of challenges as well. But there is an association, it's called the Citizen Science Association, it's informed. We and Data One helped create it several years ago. It's now on a freestanding 501c3. With hundreds of different citizen science groups from around the country and internationally. But part of this, and one of the things that the Citizen Science Association does, is it focuses on helping develop and promulgate effective standards that can be used by different citizen science networks that are forming. So if you or your agency or groups are interested in, again, moving into some more citizen science arena, I would encourage you to join the Citizen Science Association and take advantage
potential for using on-farm data as tremendously important, although I can't really say how that we've gotten very far. I work in the area of soil fertility and nutrient management, and that immediately raises some issues, including there's some proprietary issues and fear of regulation and data sharing, which I totally understand. But on the other side of it, we in extension in soil fertility and nutrient management are very few and far between. The number of field research experiments we can do, given the dollars available, are very, very sparse. And so to me, farmer data represents an untapped opportunity to really bring research together with on-farm data to improve the inference space of a recommendation that would be derived from sparse research data.
Okay, let's go over here.
I'm Maida Zavari, and I'm with the CGR Consortium in Montpellier. I'm a data and knowledge manager as well as a scientist, so I can see this sort of from both points of view. I have a comment and a question, and the comment is directed more at Jeff's question. I think, you know, we haven't really addressed the role that donors play in all of this, and I think that's really crucial. In the medical informatics sort of data revolution since the mid 80s, the donors played a huge role, especially in SF and NIH, in sort of kickstarting, making sure, keeping people in the path, broadly speaking, really, to get data and publications open. That revolution is sort of happening now. I don't think that we're at the point where donors are recommending specific repositories, but I think they are, at least the conversation seems to be happening around what are the standards that the repositories need to have to be interoperable and have that ability to, you know, expose the data at a higher level. So when I go in and do a search for a subarg intolerance rice, I can pull that up no matter where it exists. That's the idea. So that was the comment. The question is that, you know, I've heard figures thrown out about 5% of your budget as a scientist when you're writing proposals should be dedicated towards data stewardship and good management of data. My own feeling is that's actually too low for the kind of stuff we deal with because it's so messy and would require so much more attention. But even at 5%, our scientists are just absolutely flat out confused. So there's a sort of a value, a much greater value given to field research and to actually doing experiments. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what we can do to get a change of mindset, get that change so that scientists recognize the value of the data itself, curating it well, you know, putting it up, making it available. How do we get to that point? I mean, we can talk about culture change, we can talk about training. I guess I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
Thank you, Maida. Well, that's the human element. Who wants to start? Because
so as far as the data management goes, I think if you set at NIH, let's say, where clinical research is funded, that the majority of the clinical trials applications I've seen as a reviewer don't even have a section on data management. And if you're a person who's into data management, such as we are, that you've got to understand that. And so I think one of the places I put the blame is that within NIH and the training grants, the people training for research are not training about data management, it's all the Excel spreadsheet. And however you want to ask the questions about how many cigarettes you smoke, there's no understanding about standardization and that value. I think industry actually understands it because they have to, but the people we allow to do our research and the whole academic award system, I think, I mean,
this is one reason why I focus on the use cases in my presentation, because I think we need to say data for what, because then it's not just, oh, you have to do this because it's public good. It's that if you work with models, but that's the case I think is the case that I know best, your data have the potential to be used in far greater ways than you would ever dream of when you collected them. So just a quick answer. Last year at the ASA meetings, we held a side meeting on the evaporation iteration, and we invited the experimenters who do experiments on ET, and the modelers who work on ET and the modelers. We thought that maybe like, 10 people would show up. 50 people showed up, and the experimenters were really, they loved it because it was actually offering them something for the use of their data. So I think part of what we need to do is let's highlight the use cases. That's what I think will help motivate.
I would also refer to all of us that teach introductory biology, geology, or course, have at least one lecture on managing data in your field. It's really critical nowadays. I don't know how much crude school went back in the dark ages. It was required of people in the marine science field, which I was at the time, to take statistics classes so they could, learn about managing and analyzing data. We've gotten away from that in a lot of cases. I think it's particularly challenging now in this era of big data and data-driven science and so on. And we all have a role in playing there, at least introducing good basic data management concepts as part of our genome class as a great step. We've got a lot of education materials, lectures that can download through Beta 1 and incorporate into your training. And then secondly, to get back to your comment, funding agencies really are starting to recognize the role that they play in this. As much as we all hate to admit it, we don't necessarily always do the right thing, even though we may know it's the right thing, until there's a scare, the sticks or getting smacked ahead. And I think we're going to see big changes over the next year in terms of funding agencies requiring changes in how we do our science, how we manage the data, and then as part of the peer review process that's coming proposals and so on, we're going to see much more a focus on data availability after a project is completed before you're funded to do a new one. So there is going to be, I think it's going to be a combination of carrots and sticks that will move us forward in this
area. I think it's important to acknowledge right up front that it isn't just about the cost to the data generator. Because if this works, I place the data someplace else, and then I can do anything, including die. But I'm not going to leave it in my will that my data are taken care of. So I think the business model for data requires a lot of thought beyond the PI and the project. We need thought there, because nobody is budgeting for data, and sometimes when you do, it gets taken out, either by your colleagues or by the agency itself when the budgets are cut prior to the award. So there is definitely a piece there, but the whole infrastructure for data as part of our research enterprise needs to be have a business model. And I have lots of ideas, but I'm not really sure I've ever heard anything that moves me. Is this just absorbed into overhead? Where does it go?
Very good, thank you. Let's over here.
I'm Nancy Reed. I'm an entomologist with the local mosquito control district. And I have a question that's kind of left over from last night and Swami Ramaswamy's talk about communicating with the general public. And I was really interested in the Cochrane model. I have found as someone who is not in an academic institution and not in a well-funded government agency that I can't get at a lot of information that's in journals unless I want to really pay a lot of money. And I'm wondering about your thoughts about the role of journals in information dissemination.
Now, this is the problem. We actually have a coalition of consumer groups
Cochran Center called Consumers United Veterans Based Healthcare. And we use Twitter, Facebook, and so forth. And we put up important articles people should have access to. And a lot of the consumers don't have access to journals, and so I just tend to think that. But I don't know, I think there are a number of things we can do. One is the systematic reviews, which are probably more likely to be read than an entire article one by one. Probably doesn't make sense. Those, the proper next lay summary, so that it could be understood, and actually physicians use this quite a bit. And there's also structured abstract and form data needs with confidence intervals and so forth. But I think that one thing we can do as individuals is to try to get our graduate students to publish an open access term, so that that's the way we go. And even the big six in medicine, if you pay money, will make the articles open access. So we have to run into our grants money to go for publications. It's my understanding from people at NIH that the publishing companies are worse than the drug companies in terms of the profits they make out of all of our volunteer work. So I think we have to, like everything else, strategize that as well.
Also reiterate your community journals in environmental sciences at large recognize their role as well as professional societies, and they are increasingly requiring data be made available in associations with the publication. Some do it through things like dependency or supplements, and they manage those internally and their own publisher, but increasingly more and more are doing things like joining Triad. Publish all of your data in association with the paper at the same time that comes out. So if you have run a journal, or if you're looking for data, I encourage you to check out Dryad, dryad.org, and you'll find lots and lots of data that tells us information about those journals that are taking that step in the right direction.
Okay, thank you. Over here.
Dendak Athens, University of Florida. I'm a co-moderator, always very hungry for lots of data. I wanted to follow up on the quality issue experience with the Cochran approach. There are a lot of emphasis put onto assessing the quality of the data. What do you actually do with it? Is there a way of weighing it, or do you need to adjust to the users to decide of how you take this information? And a related question to that, do you have a clear cutoff or an opinion on using gray literature versus peer-reviewed literature? What's the thinking in this?
So in terms of quality, one has to first say
what
is quality mean? And the risk of bias instrument now is being revised because we typically use it for randomized trials, which are perhaps easier to assess the quality of than an observational thing because your choice is controlled over the results. And that's all transparent in the Cochrane library. I showed you the yellow, green, and red dots. But it is opinion. So opinion, and usually by two people, and then consensus is reached. But I think that all systematic review and meta-analysis data, including risk of bias assessment, should be public as well. And Cochrane doesn't make its data public so far. In 2020, it should be, but I think there are some systems now, like SRDR, which is a systematic review database. And the whole idea of that is to make the data that are in systematic reviews and meta-analysis public. Another problem with that is it hasn't been well funded, and so it may die. And it's difficult to use, but there are problems, but it hasn't been well funded, so it needs more programming. None of the available data sources, that's the only one that's open access, are, without bugs.
Gray literature.
So Cochran says you should search the gray literature, and the study we're doing now, the one I showed you, MUDS, is trying to look at just how useful gray literature is. And we're finding all kinds of things about it. First of all, the outcomes that are assessed are different from those in published literature.
marketing. It may be a way of the junior person getting to a meeting. I think the jury is out.
Okay, thank you. Over here.
Good morning. My name is Nicholas Friendly from Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. I was just wondering if it wouldn't be a good idea to put mandatory data management plans for PhD students for their the purpose of their studies. And if we achieve that, my question is, can we go a step further and ask for PhD students to perform systematic reviews or the learning curve is too steep?
I'm in the Department of Epidemiology and have failed so far to get the literature review to be systematic, which I just think is incredible because we're a methods-based department. However, I think the learning curve is steep, that people think they automatically know how to do a systematic review, and people are well-meaning but self-taught. We do teach a systematic review course, and we have a MOOC up on Coursera that's free on systematic reviews and that analysis. Nevertheless, actually having people realize that they have to work in teams, and it's not, you know, an 8-week course that makes you able to do one, and it's really difficult research. It's hard. As far as data management plans go, I know that NIH requires as part of your application a data management plan. Do you have to do it?
Other agencies don't necessarily require, unless the proposal goes in to figure a funding program. A lot of universities don't necessarily require it. I would argue that they should. That's a valuable part of our training. So when they produce a research proposal for their postdoctoral
you know, we've tried to actually, we have a pilot course for graduate students now at Purdue based on data competencies. It is not required, and those discussions, as you know, curricula are the quote purview of the faculty, and not everybody is in agreement that this is an essential need at this point, but I think we're moving more towards that as a need, just as we have moved towards the recognition that unfortunately ethics training is a need. And so I'm optimistic. I think we can get that piece into graduate education. I think we have a ways to go to develop the coursework and make it available to students who want to do systematic reviews. We'd like to do that, I think, in a typical agronomy department. I see the value of that, but getting the team together to even teach that across a domain and statistics, et cetera, all of these are just slow going. Great ideas, but I found it to be slow going.
My father's also just in a meeting of organizations, problem studies. And at that meeting, a woman I heard three stories of doctoral, postdoctoral students doing work in the tropics that had all their data essentially in a suitcase that they were bringing back. And for one reason or another, they lost all their data. The suitcase was stolen. In one case, the data were mistakenly put on a recycling pile.
Oh, God.
And this was a year or two's worth of effort. And I would argue if we had a good data management plan, that we would have saved those scientific careers an awful lot of lives.
Okay, over here, Jim.
Thanks. Jim Jones, University of Florida. I've been working in crop modeling for many years now, and wanted to, first of all, make a comment or so about the case where we were trying to harmonize model uses. We had a CASA forum back in 1992 or 3 with the idea that we were going to somehow harmonize the inputs for these crop models so that they could all be used using the same sources of data. Well, that didn't work. So we learned a lot of lessons for that. And one of the lessons that I think we learned is that this is more of a human problem, a sociological cultural problem that I think has been alluded to here somewhat. if it's not invented here, or my formats are better, or the units that I use are important, and so forth. And so that's why we went and when we started working with multiple crop models to data translation systems. And we found that the crop modelers all over the world now can use whatever format they want to use, and we have tools that will take the harmonized format that we have now have from the Acosta Data Dictionary and translate them into those for use in those models. And so now what we're attempting to do is to go on the other side and go to the databases that may already be in existence, like at Purdue and Michigan and so forth, and put translators on those into this common format that then can be used in multiple crop models or meta-analysis or statistical analysis and so forth. And so we're finding that people are buying into that. I mean, in the 13 states that are involved in the current effort, we're actually getting more people to say, yes, we want to be a part of that. One other aspect of that, though, is that not everyone has databases already on their campuses. And so they're looking for solutions. They're looking for some of these templates that they could start using and putting their data into. And my guess is that we will not be able to find one template that people will be able to use to upload their data to the National Agricultural Library, for example. But if we have a number of these templates, then I think that people can choose from those and do it. And, you know, one of the things that I've also seen in the past is that funding agencies may fund a particular solution with the idea that this is going to be exportable to other places, and it doesn't work that way. You've got to have the community behind you in order to have the acceptance on the process and the business plan and so forth to do that. And so we're hoping that that will evolve. And I think that the American Society of Agronomy, the crop societies, can play a strong role in this. I really think it's great to have this session here today, and I could see in the future maybe having some short training courses on some of these preferred or recommended templates for loading data into any one of these several possibilities as we go forward. So I wonder if you have comments from other areas that would relate to this, and also the idea of the societies playing a strong role in the future to try to educate the different people. I know you've been doing some of that already, but as we go forward, it just seems to be a need for much more of that.
I'm in violent agreement with your response. Within the long term bunch of research community, for example, several thousand. The science has played a key role in that in terms of, I'll give one example. Alan Nash was trying to do a synthesis of primary production data that was done across the different LPR sites. And he had tremendous difficulty trying to do the translation from one site's data to another and so on. And he went in there very skeptical about standards as well as, you know, protocol development and so on. But after his attempt to collate data across all these different sites, he said, well, maybe I was wrong. And he led an effort within LPR to develop standards both for data collection as well as data management across all the LPR sites, regardless of whether or not they were agro-ecosystems or urban ecosystems or tropical park ecosystems, whatever. He brought in all the experts to do that, and there's now a book on standard methods for collecting and managing productivity. And I would agree that we need to probably do more of that, where we identify a need. It's a lot easier to have people adopt common good standards that will work than trying to translate and fix things out of the past. A lot of times, very different approaches are employed, and it's teasing out the statistical differences in terms of what impact method had on the results, it's really difficult to do in a lot of cases. So oftentimes it's better to bring the community around developing good standards and then also having societies want to take a role in training those approaches to their members.
You do want to say something?
2 years ago, when Kay spoke to a group of us, she made the very eloquent point that systematic reviews and meta-analysis improves the primary science tremendously. And I would say that, you know, we often, as a field experimentalist, I often do not know what I am doing incorrectly, and or in a way that is less than useful for somebody else. I am working to my purpose. The grant funds me to work to my purpose, not to anybody else's purpose. So I think there's a huge education issue, and Nicholas's question was working towards that. I simply don't know what I don't know. And when I look at my graduate students' efforts to translate what I have told them I want reported, and a sea of color. I don't know what it is. I didn't used to see this, but now everybody has colored columns. I'm like, why? What does this mean? But I open up spreadsheets, and I see in real time the translation of my message to the students. And I should feel shame. I don't necessarily have energy. But I think education is a huge part of it. And then the workflows. We need tools to make this easier to do than not to do. Because the value to someone like me is a bit distant. Your value using my data is a bit distant.
We'll take one more question very quickly, and I'm sorry. Too much interest. We're not going to get to everybody today, but we do need to close this out. I'm going to let Dr. Fixon take the stage, but have one more question for the panel, really quick. Thank you.
Really quick. No, I actually want to thank the organizers and the speakers. I think it's been a really great discussion. I think we need to move forward into the institutional part of it, both at the three societies that have already said that they play a big role, but also the university system. How do we acknowledge when we do the things right versus when we publish a lot of small papers? And so I'd like to hear ideas from you and your experience on what things we could do at both the professional level but also the university level to make this thing happen. Thank you very much.
Okay, one thing from each of our speaker or panel. The most important thing. And then we'll let Dr. Fixon take the stage.
I won't be able to say it one more. We heard a wonderful talk on the panel last week from Donna Joe-Ellen, who was brilliant, about what if you have the data and nobody acts on it. And what she said made so much sense is you work incrementally, which I think you have to do. And she talked about, you know, the back to sleep program, putting babies to sleep on their back, et cetera. Some come to work with the diaper companies to get what to do on the diaper boxes and groups like that. And she gave many examples. And it seems, I think we just have to think of these sort of crazy approaches that seem off topic but are on topic. And she says that the biggest problem is money, and I think that's true.
Other comments from the panel? Just quick, Bill.
At the university level, if you want to have a real impact, one of the best ways to do is to establish a community of practice. What I mean by that is like bringing, let's say, the postdocs together in a department, and having them, you know, work with others to, in the case of data, for example, learning best approaches and sharing their individual approaches as well. And that's a great way to move them forward. A lot of times, focusing on bravery is a lot of when you a lot of momentum forward, so you do want to, again, I think, focus on the grad students, postdocs, and others that are open to new approaches and willing to change.
Cynthia?
Get the experimenters and the modelers together.
Okay.
That's just going to excite the students to say, we want our data in your model, because it's going to be exciting to use in ways that we never thought of. motivate them. And on the modeling side, it's going to help tremendously to have to get more data into their models and understand the conditions under which we all know the issues of collected data in the field. And what there's been such a bifurcation of the data and experimenters and the modelers. And the producers is right there. And I really want to hear what your questions have been after the session. Because that's what I think you're alluding to in the qualitative, all the great case data that you've led to the collection of is now being used in anger, and it's just tremendous success.
Sylvie.
Please, could I introduce one more concept from Sylvie Class? And that is, my name is Bruce Kimball. I've spent most of my career collecting data sets that Cynthia just mentioned. But I want to introduce that I think something that would really help get these data sets out is the concept of traveling technicians. And I can tell you that one thing that's helped me get this data out is back in the old GCTE days, there was a technician that came from the Netherlands and spent 2 weeks at my place, and they helped me get them the data out and into the hands of all the other modelers. And Robert Grant has sent graduate students down from Canada to Arizona to help with that sort of thing. So I address the AgMed people, if you can put that in your budget to send some technicians out to various experimenters' locations. You'll help get the data out there with the models. Maybe the National Ag Library could have someone do that. But anyway, that would help a lot with this education problem and actually getting the data in the formats that can be used and off of the just the paper that's sitting on people's desks.
Bruce, thank you. I'll let Sylvie respond to that. You get two thoughts.
So we actually, in a project that is with our president, Dr. Paul Fixon, we actually have a name for that individual to go out, and that's the data buddy. And we have the data buddy budgeted into a project where we are working from that premise that you cannot expect people to just do it because we say so. So my last thought on what might be something that would change our view, and I think Sonny Ramaswamy referred to it last night, that we are ripe, it was on one of his slides, we are ripe for a revisioning of the scholarship of extension. And scholarship of impact. And that opens the door to do things collaboratively and have your work used by others and valued.
Okay, I want to thank the audience for staying here, asking thoughtful questions. It was very stimulating. It's outstanding. I now invite President Paul Fixon to the podium to wrap things up. Paul.
We all staying here.
You staying here?
Okay. Well, my first duty here, and I'll keep this very short. I had a nice long speech all written out, but I'm going to forego that. All right, because it's much more important to hear your questions and to hear this world-class panel of data leaders and thinkers to respond to those questions. And I thank you all so much for a marvelous job here. Let's thank them again as a group.